Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, November 3, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we'll be discussing Spokio versus Robbins, argued yesterday in the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We welcome first-time guest today, Corey L. Andrews. He's the Senior Litigation Counsel at the Washington Legal Foundation. He was our man on the spot for the oral argument. He's going to give us opening remarks of about 20 to 30 minutes, after which, as always, we'll be turning to the audience for questions, so please do be thinking of those questions. With that, Mr. Andrews, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a longtime listener and happy to participate in today's program. As a lot of your listeners will know, federal courts have been inundated in recent years by suits filed by plaintiffs who have suffered no concrete injury but who allege that some federal statute provides them with standing to sue for the bare violation of federal law. Now, when filed as class actions, these statutory violations can be extremely lucrative for the plaintiff's bar, especially when the statute provides for an award of statutory damages, which typically runs from $100 up to $1,000 per violation. And so by filing their suits as nationwide class actions, attorneys can plausibly seek, in some cases, to recover into the billions of dollars. Spokio v. Robbins involves claims under the Fair Credit Reporting Act, one of dozens of federal statutes that offers a bounty in the form of statutory damages to those who demonstrate a violation of federal law. Spokio, Inc. operates a people search engine, a website that aggregates publicly available information from phone books, social networks, and other sources into a database that is searchable via the Internet and displays the results of that search online. The FCRA governs consumer reporting agencies, and one of the key issues if this case were ever to proceed to the merit stage would be whether Spokio is even subject to the FCRA at all. Spokio denies that it is a credit bureau since it doesn't purport to evaluate anyone's creditworthiness. In fact, Spokio has always emphasized in disclaimers that it does not verify or evaluate any piece of data and doesn't guarantee the accuracy of any information that it offers. But at this stage, that they are a credit agency is pled in the complaint, and we accept that as true. The plaintiff in this case, Thomas Robbins, claims that Spokio, which posted some innocuous but technically incorrect information about him, we'll get to later, violated his rights under the FCRA. Robbins alleges that Spokio failed, for example, to take steps required of consumer reporting agencies under the statute, including failed to post a toll-free telephone number to allow consumers to request consumer reports, failed to issue notices to providers and users of information to tell them of their rights and responsibilities under the FCRA, and it also failed to follow reasonable procedures to assure maximum possible accuracy of the information it posted. Now, the FCRA provides that anyone who willfully fails to comply with the FCRA is subject to either actual or statutory damages, somewhere between $100 and $1,000. And Section 1681P provides an action to enforce any liability created under the statute can be brought in any appropriate U.S. District Court without regard to the amount of controversy. And so the question the Supreme Court has agreed to answer in this case is whether Robbins, the plaintiff, has suffered an injury in fact sufficient to confer standing under Article 3. Now, the Supreme Court had agreed to address this same legal question several years ago in the context of the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, but the court ended up dismissing that case, First American Financial Corp. v. Edwards, as improvidently granted, perhaps because the justices concluded after oral argument that the supposedly uninjured plaintiffs may have actually suffered some discrete tangible injury. But as every first-year law student is taught, to establish Article III standing to sue in federal court, a plaintiff must show an injury in fact that is concrete, particularized, and actual, or at the very least imminent, fairly traceable to the defendant's conduct and redressable by a favorable ruling. In the 1992 decision Lujan v. Defenders of Wildlife, the Supreme Court held that the invasion of statutory rights is sufficient by itself to create standing, but only if those rights consist of, quote, concrete de facto injuries that were previously inadequate in law, but that now, by virtue of the newly adopted statute, have been elevated to the status of legal cognizable injuries. In this case, Robin's primary answer to the question of injury is that Spokio provided inaccurate information about him. But what were Spokio's alleged inaccuracies? Well, according to the complaint, that Robbins had a graduate degree. He did not. That he wasn't employed in a technical or professional field. In fact, he says he was unemployed and looking for work. That his economic health was very strong. Apparently it wasn't. That he was married with children. He was neither. And that his wealth level was in the top 10%. Also allegedly false. So, is that a de facto injury? Robbins claimed in the operative complaint that Spokio's inaccuracies caused harm to his, quote, employment prospects, resulting in anxiety, stress, concern, and worry that those inaccuracies might affect his ability to obtain credit, employment insurance, and the like. But ultimately, Robbins was unable to allege facts in the complaint showing that any of these potential harms had in fact occurred or were imminent. As a result, Judge Otis Wright of the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California disagreed with Robbins and ultimately dismissed the suit on the basis that a mere violation of the FCRA does not confer Article III standing, where no injury in fact is properly pled. The District Court found that Robbins did not sufficiently plead a concrete injury because any alleged harm to his employment prospects remained speculative, attenuated, and implausible. On appeal, the Ninth Circuit reversed. In a unanimous opinion written by Judge O'Scanlan, the panel held that because Congress intended to create a statutory right under the FCRA, a bare violation of that right was sufficient to satisfy the injury in fact requirement of Article III. Adopting the Sixth Circuit position in Beaudry v. Telecheck Services, the panel held that Robbins was among the injured because Spokio allegedly violated his statutory rights, not just the statutory rights of other people. And because the FCRA protects against individual rather than collective harm, the panel concluded that Robbins' personal interest in the handling of his credit information was individualized rather than collective and sufficed for Article III standing. Most notably, and I think most important in this case, the appeals court expressly refused to premise Robbins' standing on the alleged harm to his employment prospects or any of the resulting psychic injury or anxiety that he pled in his operative complaint. Instead, almost gift-wrapping the question presented and putting a bow on top, the Ninth Circuit clarified that Robbins satisfied the injury in fact threshold of Article III solely on the basis of Spokio's alleged violation of his statutory rights, nothing more. So the Ninth Circuit deemed it irrelevant that Robbins could not identify any concrete or particularized injury. Rather, it concluded that any statutory violation directed at an individual is sufficient to establish standing to sue for that individual. By providing for statutory damage awards under the FCRA to individual plaintiffs who cannot prove any actual damages, Congress clearly intended to encourage individuals to file suits alleging noncompliance with federal law. As the Ninth Circuit explained, because the FCRA does not require a showing of actual harm when a plaintiff sues for willful violations, a plaintiff can sue for violation of a statutory right without having suffered actual damages. But the question raised by Spokio is whether the Constitution permits federal courts or permits Congress to force federal courts to maintain jurisdiction to hear lawsuits filed by individuals whose only injury consists of violation of a statute creating legal rights. That question has never squarely been addressed by the court, and it has sharply divided the federal courts of appeals. So, at oral argument yesterday and in the merits briefs, the case on behalf of Spokio was forcefully made by Supreme Court veteran Andy Pincus of Mayor Brown. As he explains, the court has consistently said that the irreducible constitutional minimum for standing to sue in federal court is injury in fact, that the plaintiff suffered an actual tangible harm. While Congress, as in Lujan, may elevate to the status of legally cognizable injuries that were previously inadequate at law, that is not what the Ninth Circuit did here. Rather, the Ninth Circuit held that there is no need for any de facto injury. All that is required is a statutory violation that in some general sense relates to the plaintiff, even if the violation has no tangible consequences. By authorizing federal courts to enforce federal statutes at the behest of individuals who suffered no concrete injury caused by the alleged violation, the decision below constitutes a significant relaxation of Article III standing requirement and thus erodes the separation of powers, which has long been understood to be the very basis of Article III standing threshold. William Consovoy of Consovoy McCarthy Park is counsel of record for the plaintiff, Mr. Robbins. He argues that a bare violation of the statutory rights conferred under the FCR constitutes an injury in fact. Even if it doesn't, his entitlement to monetary relief as a consequence of the violation provides him with the personal stake that Article III requires. And echoing the government's position, the Solicitor General's office filed two briefs in this case, one at cert stage and one on the merits. Mr. Robbins contends that the fact that his claim follows from the common law of defamation satisfies the case or controversy requirement of Article III. Andy Pincus pushed back hard on the notion that the FCRA evinces an intent by Congress to somehow single out or elevate false information as a kind of quintessential harm in this case. He pointed out that the willfulness cause of action that provides for statutory damages applies to any violation of the statute that's willful, including those that don't involve false statements, such as not providing an 800 number, not following proper procedures. The government suggests that the proper approach in the case is to determine whether the federal statute protects an interest that was also protected at common law. He argues that at common law, an individual could sue others for publishing inaccurate information about him, and that evidence of an injury was not required because injury could be presumed to flow from the inaccurate information. And there's strong reason to doubt the accuracy of the Solicitor General's claim, as Justice Scalia did at the oral argument, that there's a presumed injury based on any inaccuracy as opposed to a libelous inaccuracy that exposes the plaintiff to contempt or ridicule. For example, the restatement of torts defines defamation per se as one who publishes matter defamatory to another in such a manner as to make the publication a slander. And even if it doesn't result in a harm, the slander has to relate to a criminal offense, a loathsome disease, a matter incompatible with his business, trade, profession, or office, or some serial sexual misconduct. That is probably more likely what defamation looked like at the common law. But the important point here is that it is not the approach adopted by the Ninth Circuit in this case. In fact, none of the arguments made by the government were the approach the Ninth Circuit took in this case. And that, in a way, almost foreordains the result in this case, I think. So following our oral argument, I see three possibilities. The most unlikely outcome is going to be an affirmance of the Ninth Circuit and an embrace of the appeals court's reasoning. Yesterday at oral argument, only Justice Sotomayor and perhaps Justice Ginsburg appeared willing to defend the suggestion that a bare statutory violation is in and of itself an injury, in fact, under Article III. But as their hypotheticals made clear, both the Chief Justice and Justice Scalia were very skeptical of the idea of statutory standing. In fact, Chief Justice Roberts wrote a law review article highly critical of the notion of statutory standing while he was still in private practice. Justice Scalia, too, has published and taught on the separation of powers concerns that animate Article III standing. At one point, Roberts even expressed surprise that the government apparently had no interest in defending the exclusive prerogative of the executive branch to enforce federal law. Justice Alito's questioning, too, seemed to focus on the lack of real-world consequence for Robbins as a result of Spokio's actions. At one point, he got Consovoy to admit that there was no record evidence to suggest that anyone other than Mr. Robbins ever searched for his name on the website. And so that leaves us with the third possibility. Justice Kagan, and perhaps only slightly to a lesser extent Justice Breyer, they appeared more interested in the question that the Ninth Circuit didn't answer. That is, whether he did allege an injury in fact, not whether he didn't have to. They seemed influenced by the government's contention that providing false information alone is a kind of dignitary harm that courts have long recognized, and that Robbins was just the kind of person the law intends to compensate for such an injury. The main problem with this third way, again, as Justice Roberts repeatedly reminded everyone yesterday, is that that was not the basis for the Ninth Circuit's holding. And so in order to agree with the government, that would at the very least require a conclusion that the Ninth Circuit's rationale was dead wrong. No injury cases of this sort are a plaintiff's lawyer's dream come true, especially in a class action setting. If individual plaintiffs are claiming actual damages, it may be very difficult for counsel to get the case certified as a class action because common issues of fact are unlikely, and they won't predominate over individual issues, which is a prerequisite under Rule 23. But if the only injury suffered by every putative class member is the violation of a statutory provision, and the only relief claimed is the recovery of statutory damages, there are unlikely to be very many obstacles to class certification since virtually every class member's claim will be identical. By reversing the Ninth Circuit and Spokio, the court can help bring a halt to the proliferation of lawsuits filed by uninjured plaintiffs who lack the requisite Article III standing to sue for infractions of federal statutes. Doing so will ensure that the primary responsibility for ensuring that the laws are faithfully executed remains where it belongs, in the executive branch. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We appreciate you having taken time to attend the oral argument and to address us here today. Let's open the floor to questions now. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. Before we move forward, let me announce our next scheduled telephone conference call. It's Thursday at 2 o'clock with former Senator Saxby Chambliss. We'll be talking about whether or not the intelligence community has the tools it needs to win the war on terrorism. That's Thursday at 2 o'clock. Today, of course, we're talking about the Spokio case. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. I don't see any questions just yet, so I will ask the first question. And it is, you mentioned, I think, seven of nine justices. You didn't mention Justice Thomas or Justice Kennedy and what happened with them at oral argument or any sense of where they might be headed in terms of a decision. Do you have a strong read on them? I mean, Justice Kennedy is often silent on the bench, but is there anything in his jurisprudence or that of Justice Kennedy that leads you to sort of an inkling?
Well, you're right. Justice Thomas did not ask any questions yesterday, which is his practice. I have no problem with that practice. I think he has the excellent reasons that he's articulated. But just looking at the prior cases, in particular Lujan, Summers, and Clapper, those are three cases that were closely divided, 5-4 decisions, where the court sort of imposed some very real-world limitations on a plaintiff's threshold standing. I think it's probably safe to assume that he shares the concerns, the separation of powers concerns, that Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, and Alito articulated yesterday. Justice Kennedy was in his normal sort of Hamlet role. He asked equal questions of both sides. I will note that he concurred with the majority in Lujan, and he joined the majorities in those two cases, Summers and Clapper. And at one point, he, borrowing from his concurrence in Lujan, he reminded counsel for Robbins that the standard was a de facto injury, not just a statutory injury. So I think there's a decent chance there are five members of the court that are prepared to overturn the Ninth Circuit. Exactly how they'll draw the chalk lines, I'm not sure. But I would be surprised if we get a rule that says that the mere violation of a statute is enough to get into federal court.
Once again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We have one question pending, and then our lines will be open. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Yeah, hi, Corey. That was an excellent presentation. This is Phil Goldstein. Robin seems to be arguing that if Congress identifies an injury or concrete injury and then adopts a statute that has a prophylactic effect to deter that injury, then there's no need to allege that the injury that Congress sought to deter actually occurred. So, you know, he's claiming inaccuracies, but no matter how trivial or inconsequential they are, that the injury has occurred. But it seems like the same old circular logic that Justice Kennedy criticized in the first American oral argument. I just want to say that someone posted without my knowledge a Wikipedia page about me, and it's pretty accurate, but it says incorrectly that I was born in Brooklyn, and while I lived most of my life in Brooklyn, I was born in Maryland. So I just want, if this case goes the other way, I'm ready to file a class action lawsuit on that. Everybody who's been maligned. I mean, it's gotta have some, you know, some bad effect on the person. I mean, just to say, gotcha, you made a mistake. You said I was 47 years old. I'm really 48. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah,
I don't really have a question here, but I just wonder what your reaction is to that.
No, I mean, I think your points are all well taken. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the circularity of the reasoning is especially evident in the sort of the second argument that Robbins made, which was that it's his interest in getting the bounty that gives him sort of the teeth in the game to have standing. So it's sort of bootstrapping the statutory damages as his reason why he gets to walk into the court. I can't imagine anything more sort of tautological than that. But at the end of the day, if you know, and I think this is an argument that the Washington Legal Foundation made in our brief, if the person hasn't been personally harmed by the statutory violation, what they're really doing is they are suing because there's a violation of federal law. And Article 2 tells us that it's the executive's exclusive prerogative and responsibility to see that the laws are faithfully enforced. And so to that extent, again, Justice Roberts was surprised that the government was taking the position it was. Some of us aren't surprised, but it is a real concern that plaintiffs can just file suits without having actually been injured because someone somewhere isn't obeying federal law and those sorts of, you know, I think that's the outer realm of the slippery slope that we could be down if the Ninth Circuit's holding survives.
Thanks.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one caller pending, then our lines are wide open. Let's take another call.
Hi, this is Bill Hodes from Florida. I'm very sympathetic to the argument against citizen standing and against no injury standing, but it seems to me that if you push that too far, you get a different separation of powers difficulty, which is you deprive Congress of the power to legislate the rights that it, to create rights that it clearly, you know, has the constitutional jurisdiction to do. And the counterexample I would give, and I don't have all the details, but what if Congress, as it has done in Section 1983 and many other civil rights areas, creates a very, very stringent right not to have a particular constitutional right violated, and someone, a police officer or somebody else, violates it, but in an extremely trivial, no harm way. They search somebody, nothing is found, nobody is prosecuted, there's not much, you know, there's really no harm, sort of, no foul. If you say that that's not concrete enough, what have you done to Congress's power to say, no, damn it, we want private attorneys general to be able to take action, thus taking away the argument that we're denying the executive branch power, because that's what you always do in private attorney general type action?
Well, the separation of powers is intended to prevent the accumulation of power in any one branch. And here you have Congress's power to legislate and to provide for remedies for rights that are violated, but you also have Article 3 of the Constitution that says that the jurisdiction of the courts is limited to cases and controversies. And as Justice Roberts said yesterday, that has to be up to the court to decide. If the separation of powers is to retain any meaning, that is a judicial determination by the Supreme Court. It can't belong to another branch. And, you know, there were a lot of amicus briefs filed on the other side that laid out a sort of parade of horribles of what might happen if the court cuts back in standing in too much. There's nothing in this case that requires a particular result in a civil rights case. I can guarantee you the opinion that's issued in this case is going to be limited to the Fair Credit Reporting Act. There may be principles that in this case that are extended by courts and by parties into other cases and tried and tested. But just as is the case here with the Fair Credit Reporting Act, the government is also able to bring suits for cognizable deprivations of this statute. In fact, the Fair Credit Reporting Act says that any violation is itself a violation or constitutes a deceptive and unfair trade practice under Section 5 of the FTC Act. And that allows the FTC to prosecute it. And there's also a provision that allows a host of other government agencies to police credit bureaus. So whereas, I guess, in the ordinary situation, the citizen suit is the backstop to the government enforcement. In these settings, the government enforcement is the backstop to the citizen suit. But in vast majority of these suits, there's going to be some sort of harm that could be shown. I mean, for example, if I think in this case, if Spokio had even just mistakenly reported that he had a criminal conviction, I think that does get him past the finish line into a concrete harm to his reputation. But in this case, which is almost seems tailor-made for a Supreme Court ruling, everything that Spokio said put him in a better light than he otherwise would be.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm sympathetic to all of those arguments, and I'm quite, it seems highly likely that Congress went too far here, but I'll just follow up and subside just by saying that, of course, I agree that all justiciability issues are ultimately for the Supreme Court to decide, including standing. But the question here is, in making that decision, in this case, I think Congress went too far. But there could be, if the court goes too far in disallowing Congress to create standing, then it might shift the separation of powers to a position slightly and inappropriately disfavoring Congress. The court has said, many times, our Article III gives us jurisdiction over over violation of rights, and Congress, if it can do anything, it can certainly create rights. And so the question is statutory rights. And so the question then really is, how concrete must the right and its violation be that Congress has created? I think this case, Congress went too far, but all I'm suggesting is that I hope the court knocks this down, but keeps it limited to this statute and doesn't make any too broad provisions, because that would cut into Congress's power.
I think that's a fair concern. I think that the court will have a modest ruling, and I think that however modest the ruling is, the very concerns that you have laid out will be spread across the editorial pages of every paper in the country the day after the ruling is announced, and certainly the concerns you've expressed will be front and center in front of the country on that day.
Yep.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got but one caller question pending. Let's take another call now.
Have you heard anything about class action lawyers setting up websites to complain about objectors and objector litigation and trying to vilify objectors? I know that Reuters was doing a story on that, and what do you think? Do you have any comments on that, or the utility of objectors in class action litigation?
I haven't followed that issue. I did not see the Reuters story. The plaintiff's bar is very resourceful and ingenuitive advancing its agenda, but I think, objectors serve a very valuable purpose. Members of the class have standing to object that the settlement is not fair, and it's a very nice way for members of the class to regulate the class counsel and the parties and their counsel. So but beyond that, I'm not aware of that phenomenon, and I'm not exactly sure how it might play in here, other than maybe the suggestion that websites posted about objectors might be sort of actionable. But I think, as in every case, that answer is likely to be that there will always be some people who have standing under any given cause of action and some people who don't. You simply have to look at whether the plaintiff has genuinely been injured in fact, not merely in law, and that some plaintiffs will be able to proceed if they can make the showing that they are injured. And I think that would govern that circumstance as well.
I know that some class action lawyers have argued that objectors don't have standing to perform discovery and do other things in the case. Their standing is much more limited in deciding the fairness of the settlement.
Okay. It would seem to me that they have they have standing because they have they're a member of the class, and therefore they have standing in the outcome of this of the settlement that's reached, whether it's settled, and on what terms it's settled. I mean, if they're a member of the class and they qualify as a member of the class, this is actually depending on the circumstances. This is one of the issues that the Supreme Court is going to get to next week in Tyson's Food. So there is an issue in class actions, and unlike even though Spokio was a class action, I don't think the court is going to take up a lot of Rule 23 types of concerns. In particular, this case was resolved on a 12B1 motion for, you know, lack of subject matter jurisdiction. But one of the questions the court granted in Tyson's Food, and Tyson's Food is a case brought under the Fair Labor Standards Act, where even the plaintiff's own trial evidence established that there were at least 200 members of the class that suffered no injury whatsoever, that they were owed no money whatsoever. They were included in the class, and they were included in the settlement as well. And so the courts have been split over whether just the named plaintiff in a class has to satisfy Article III standing, or whether every member of the class has to satisfy Article III standing. And I think those are the kinds of Rule 23 thornier issues that I hope, at least, that the court will take up since it's granted the question in Tyson's Food, which will be argued next week.
Thank you so much for your presentation. Bye-bye.
This is Dean, and once again, our lines are open. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me step in and mention Tyson's Food is argued next Tuesday, a week from today, on the 10th. We will have a teleforum, Courthouse Steps teleforum, Tuesday at 2 p.m. next week with Karen Harned talking about some of those issues. Also, as to objectors, interveners, we've hosted teleforum conference calls, several of them in the past, I think most prominently featuring Ted Frank, who's been involved as an objector and an intervener bringing some of those lawsuits in the past. If listeners are interested in that topic, you can go to the Federalist Society's website, look up Practice Group Podcasts, and search the recorded calls there. There are quite a few of them, actually. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if there are any more questions, let me ask you a question again, Corey, if I could. Is there the potential for backfire here, or an unintended consequence, perhaps, if the court does say that there's a concrete injury required for standing? Do these cases then maybe in the future come up through state courts, where the defense counsel presumably wouldn't want them?
Well, yes, that's a very good question. In fact, it's the old saying, be careful what you wish for, right? So defendants always want to be in federal court. They almost never want to be in state court. But if you might say in this case, if these suits – well, first of all, Article III's requirements of an injury in fact don't apply to state courts. I mean, some state courts have that requirement, but many do not. And with very few exceptions like admiralty, bankruptcy, patent, and antitrust, every federal statute is presumed to support concurrent jurisdiction among the federal and the state courts. So what happens if the plaintiffs get kicked out of federal court on a motion for lack of standing or just on a remand? Either way, it doesn't really matter because res judicata does not attach unless there's an adjudication on the merits. And a dismissal or a remand for lack of subject matter jurisdiction by definition doesn't reach the merits. So nothing is to prevent all of these suits being brought in state court, governed by state court procedures, ruled on by state court judges, and decided by state court juries, potentially, although I think a lot of them would settle. But it is something to flag, I think. I think ultimately if that sort of thing were to get too out of hand, that Congress might need to step in and do something. But I think your point is very well taken.
Let me make a final call for questions. We still have some time left. If you have a question, now's the time to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Well, I don't see that final question, so let me revert to you, Corey Andrews, and see if you have a statement you want to use to sum up here before we adjourn.
Sure. How will standing look different after Spokio? I think the answer is very likely to be the entirely reasonable but modest suggestion that was made by Justice Roberts, which is that there will always be someone who has standing under a given statute, and there will always be someone who doesn't. You simply just have to look at whether the plaintiff has genuinely been injured in fact, and some plaintiffs will be able to proceed if they can make that showing, while others may not. But by reversing the Ninth Circuit in Spokio, I do believe the court can really help bring a halt to the proliferation of these no-injury lawsuits that are filed by plaintiffs who lack the requisite Article III standing to sue for very, technical infractions of federal law. Only then will that ensure that the primary responsibility for ensuring that the laws are faithfully executed remains where it belongs, and that's in the executive branch.
Well, my thanks, Corey Andrews. We certainly appreciate your time today and your time yesterday in attending oral argument. Thank you so much to our audience. Thank you for dialing in, and thanks for your questions. A reminder that our next scheduled telephone conference call is Thursday at 2 p.m. when we'll be visiting with former Senator Saxby Chambliss. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.